Okay, here we go.
And tell me what you might see. I've got an answer, especially when it's concerning me. 'Cause I'm a good man. I always do it right. Stop, think it over, then tell you who you think I am. I've got a question to you. I can, 'cause I'm a good man. Even late at night, you don't need no question, 'cause I always do it right. And when the party's over and the moon tries to kiss the sun, let me find a reason to touch you for a run. And if you don't believe me, let your heart lead your mind. 'Cause this good man is, 'cause this good man is just so hard to find. Stop, think it over, then tell me what you might see. I've got an answer, especially when it's concerning me. 'Cause I'm a good man. Even late at night, you don't need no question.
Some great answers,
especially when it's concerning me. 'Cause I'm a good man. Late at night, don't ask me no questions, 'cause I always do it right. Come on, let's move it just a little bit faster, baby. I'm a good man. I'm a good man. Just let your heart lead your mind astray.
All right, welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Thank you very much for joining us. Today's guest is Kevin Lewis, the Conservation Policy Director for the group Idaho's Rivers United. The group's mission is to protect and restore the rivers of Idaho. They focus on building river protection campaigns that effectively team up staff and volunteers. Kevin, how are you today? Oh, boy. Let's see here. We might have a little technical difficulties here. I'm going to see if we still have Kevin on the line.
Kevin,
can you hear me? All right. So what we'll do here is we'll play a song. And then we'll try and see if Kevin is still on the line. And we will be with you in just a couple minutes. This is KRFP, Moscow.
My tears are falling. hear that, can you?
And welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Show. We're going to give this a second chance. Joining us today is Kevin Lewis, the Conservation Policy Director for Idaho Rivers United. The group's mission is to protect and restore the rivers of Idaho. They focus on building river protection campaigns that effectively team up staff and volunteers. Kevin, how are you today, and can you hear us?
Brett, I can hear you finally, and I'm great.
All right, great, Kevin. Well, thank you for being patient and for taking time out of your day. I know you're on mountain time, and dinner's around the corner. So let's just jump right into the interview here. I was wondering if you could please tell our listeners a bit about Idaho Rivers United, such as when was the group started, and what is your role as Conservation Policy Director?
Sure. So Idaho Rivers United, or IRU as we call ourselves, was founded 22 years ago in 1990. Basically, we were kind of a spin-off of Friends of the Payette, who was formed to fight a misguided effort to basically dry up the North Fork of the Payette for hydropower generation. So when Friends of the Payette finally beat the hydropower developers, I think they were wondering, well, what do we do now? So let's form a statewide group, and that is pretty much the genesis for Idaho Rivers United. So my job is as the conservation policy director, or conservation director, whatever you want to call me, I wear a lot of hats. We're a nonprofit organization like Friends of the Clearwater is. So we're governed by a volunteer board of directors who set our mission, develop our strategic plan and set up our priorities. So part of my job is just making sure that the work we do gets us to the direction that our board wants to see us at. Our yearly planning has to look towards our strategic plan to make sure that we're doing the right things and not getting sidetracked by other issues. As you know, there's a million issues that come up all the time, you can easily get sidetracked, pulled away from things that are really important. So a big part of my job is making sure that we do stay on focus. Secondly, I do hands-on conservation work as well. So we're a small staff, and so I'm also a hands-on conservation person.
Well, Kevin, I can certainly relate to the various hats that you and other employees at Idaho Rivers United has to wear, and I know you work very hard at your job, and you also enjoy your job, and so I wanted to talk a little bit about the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. In 1968, as you know, Congress passed the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. And maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about what did that visionary legislation say, and why is it so important?
Sure. Not to age myself, but I was a sophomore in high school when the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act was passed. And I'd actually already been a river runner for 4 or 5 years at that point. So I've been a river runner most of my life, and the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act was basically passed as a response to the massive dam building craze that went on in the 1950s and 1960s into the 1970s. Visionaries such as Frank Church from Idaho realized that you just can't dam every river. You got to keep some of this stuff, you know, as it was for other uses, for other enjoyments. So that was really the vision for the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, and it's a simple act. It's not tough at all. It's not a really complicated act. Basically, it's designed to preserve the status quo. When you designate a river as wild and scenic, you're basically trying to lock that river in as it is when you designate it. As part of the process, you identify the outstandingly remarkable values of that river, and the act basically directs the federal managing agencies, usually Forest Service or BLM or Park Service, and their responsibility is to protect and improve those outstandingly remarkable values. We call them ORVs. So it's a pretty simple act. It's a very important act because it's states may not be as diligent in protecting some of our free-flowing rivers. Adding that federal layer is really important, especially in states such as Idaho, where there is not as much concern placed on many of our great rivers.
Now, so speaking of rivers in Idaho, Kevin, and for those of you that are just joining us here on the Wild Clearwater Country Show, today we are joined by Conservation Policy Director and Jack of All Trades, Kevin Lewis, with the group Idaho Rivers United. So Kevin, today I was spending some time on your group's website, and I saw that it says Idaho has more pristine wild rivers than any other state besides Alaska. Went on to say that there are more than 100 rivers in Idaho that are eligible to be part of the National Wild and Scenic Rivers System, but that only 8 in the entire state are included in the federal system. I was wondering if you could identify 3 or 4 of those rivers, of the 100 rivers, and what is your group doing to get them federally designated as wild and scenic?
Sure. A lot of those 100 rivers are, there are some what we call main stem rivers. So many more would be tributary streams. So up in your part of the country, you've got the North Fork Clearwater, Fish Creek, Lolo Creek, Meadow Creek, Hungry Creek. A lot of tributaries to the Middle Fork Clearwater and Lauksaw are all eligible for wild and scenic designation. And it pretty much goes that way across the state. We do have a tremendous amount. As far as getting new rivers designated, it's tough in this state because the state of Idaho has a policy opposing federal wild and scenic designations. The state believes that they should be able to do this under the State Protected River Program, which we don't necessarily believe. Yes, they can. The question is, will they? I think the answer is pretty much no anymore. And if they want to remove a river from designation, all it takes is one vote from the legislature. We know how that works. So we're a firm believer in federal protections. I mean, these rivers are on public lands that are owned by all Americans, national forest lands. And so we believe strongly in federal protection for these rivers. In the past, we, several years ago, finally achieved the Oahe Initiative, which was 317 miles of new wild and scenic down in the Canyonland country. So the Bruno, Little Jack's, Big Jack's Creek, a lot of tributary streams were all included in designation. And that was based on the Oahe Initiative, a collaborative work group that spent about 8 years negotiating wilderness and wild and scenic protections, along with releases of some lands for traditional uses down there. So that's one way to do this, through collaborative processes. They're very long and drawn out, and when you get involved in collaborative process, you have to be careful that you're not giving away the store, so to speak. You want to make sure that you're being true to yourself and just not trying to stack up, like wild scenic protections at the expense of other things that should be protected as well. several years ago, we took a run at finalizing the designation for the lower salmon. It's been eligible and suitable for wild scenic protection for like 30 years now, but it's never taken that final step through Congress. And we spent a couple years working to make that happen, and got together a bunch of supporters and worked on it. And ultimately, we're pretty much KO'd by the jet boat crowd, who believes that wild scenic will somehow affect their rights to use the river, and that's kind of where it ended. So getting a standalone wild and scenic bill through in Idaho right now is virtually impossible. You might be able to do it through a collaborative process, but even that's going to take years and years and years. And so IRU, we've kind of shifted our focus a little bit. I mean, we're still watching for opportunities, but more important right now, I think, to us is protecting the wild and scenic we have, and also the eligible and suitable wild and scenic out there. All three designations, so to speak, need to be protected, as we found out on the Lock Saw and Middle Fork Clearwater.
Well, that's a perfect segue, Kevin. Currently, your group, Idaho Rivers United, is involved in a federal lawsuit that claims that the Forest Service and the Federal Highway Administration failed to uphold the law and their responsibilities in allowing Exxon Imperial megaloads to travel within a wild and scenic river corridor and along a federally designated scenic byway. Could you please tell our listeners where do things stand right now with this federal case?
Sure. The first of September, our attorneys filed their opening briefs and motions for summary judgment. I think we initially filed this litigation back in March of 2011. So it's been a year and a half now, and there'll be a number of rounds of filings and cross filings, and with some kind of luck, we might be before a judge in the springtime. It's hard to say. These federal cases go very slowly.
Kevin, maybe you could touch on, you've spoken to just what is a wild and scenic river corridor, and certainly the connection there between this federal case with the wild and scenic river corridor and the Forest Service is that the Forest Service is responsible for upholding the values of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. How about the involvement of the Federal Highway Administration and their responsibilities pertaining to a federally designated scenic byway?
Sure. Well, I'm not too sure if I know very much about the scenic byway component, but I'll definitely talk about the wild and scenic part of it. So, wild and scenic is more than just a river. Wild and scenic is basically a corridor. It's a river and it's nearby environment. So in the designation, basically you have the river, and you have the lands on a quarter mile each side of the river, which become part of the wild scenic corridor. And on Highway 12 actually, is within that quarter mile area along the river. So Highway 12, for the most part, is within the wild scenic corridor. And really, the essence of our lawsuit against the Forest Service and the Federal Highway Administration is that we believe that the Forest Service had a responsibility to, at the very minimum, assess the impacts of megaload shipments through that corridor, assess the impacts on the ORVs, remember the outstanding remarkable values, it's all the values that were identified that river brings to the people. And part of some of those values are aesthetics and scenery and water quality. That. So, at the very least, we believe the Forest Service should have stepped up and assessed the impacts or the possible impacts of megaloads and made some kind of a decision as to what might be appropriate and what wouldn't be appropriate for that highway corridor. Instead, the Forest Service took a different tack and basically said, well, the state of Idaho has an easement for Highway 12, therefore we have no control over it, therefore we don't like megaloads, but we have no control. Sorry. We don't accept that. I think there's plenty of federal case law that shows that the Forest Service, even though the state has an easement, there's certainly sideboards to that easement. And that's kind of the heart of the litigation. And the Federal Highway Administration is the entity that basically conveys the easement from the Forest Service to the state of Idaho. So that's why they became party to this litigation, is they were the party that actually transferred the easement. Keep in mind that the easement for Highway 12 was only created 20 years after Wild Scenic Designation. When that area was designated Wild and Scenic, Highway 12 was on special use permits. It didn't even have an actual highway easement. And so the easement was created after Wild and Scenic Designation.
Right. So, in other words, in a certain way, you're saying, besides the merits of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, besides that act standing alone on itself, it's not like the scenic easement or the easement being transferred to the state or what have you preceded the visionary legislation that protected the corridor in the first place.
Absolutely not. I mean, it's clear that Highway 12 existed. Highway 12 was completed about 1962, I think. And so there was a normal and customary use of Highway 12 at the time that Wild and Scenic Designation was passed by Congress. Keep in mind that the Middle Fork Clearwater and Loxaw were some of the original rivers named in the original Act, 1968. In fact, alphabetically, they were the first rivers named in the Act. And so when you know, you have like a normal and customary use. You have the highway traffic that was going on at that time. And obviously that was consistent with Wild and Scenic Designation. I mean, this area is, you know, there's three levels of designation. There's wild, there's scenic, and there's recreational. And those levels basically are determined by the amount of development along the river. So if you have a wild river, it's going to have like no development. No roads, no motorized use. It's going to be in the wilderness area or near wilderness area. Scenic, you've got some level of development. And then recreational, you'll have a highway along the river. You may have a railroad along the river. You'll have bridges across the river. You'll have towns. You'll have houses. You'll have private parcels. So that's kind of how they differentiate between wild, scenic, and recreational. But the important thing is that none of those designations is stronger than the other. In other words, just because it's designated recreational doesn't mean you treat it any less than if it was wild. In other words, you identify the ORVs, you're required to protect and enhance the ORVs, and that's it. So you had a level of use on Highway 12 that everybody recognizes and accepts. Highway 12 does provide interstate commerce between Idaho and Montana, but when you go back and look at some of the early documents on Highway 12 and the documents on the National Scenic Byway, which is what Highway 12 is designated as, and an All-American Road, it's pretty clear that the intent of Highway 12, even though it does carry commerce, was that it's more of a scenic highway. And that's how it's used. I mean, when you go up there in the summertime, see the kind of use on Highway 12. You've got a ton of motorcycle touring, you've got bicycle touring, you've got a lot of sightseeing. Of course, you have river use, hikers, hunters. I mean, you have a whole plethora of use on Highway 12, of which a component is interstate use. But nobody, no way ever envisioned laying skyscrapers on their side and dragging them down Highway 12 as a normal use of that highway.
No, and I'm laughing. Skyscrapers on their side. That's another way of putting it. I recall seeing an ad in the Boise Weekly that had the Statue of Liberty laying on its side, and comparing it to the size of a megalod, and they were comparable. Or a T-Rex. I think they had a T-Rex maybe on its side, and you know. So nonetheless. So this will be a very interesting case, and certainly applaud Idaho Rivers United and I believe Advocates for the West, who's representing you or your group on this very, very important case. Now, for those of you that are just tuning in here today, we're joined by Kevin Lewis, Conservation Policy Director for the group Idaho Rivers United. And Kevin, let's shift gears, even though it's on a related note. IRU, Idaho Rivers United, recently issued a news release claiming that extension of the dock at the Port of Lewiston, quote, wastes valuable federal funds and is a poor investment. Why does IRU think that dock extension at the Port of Lewiston is a bad idea?
Let me count the ways. So one of our IRU's high priorities is the restoration of Idaho's wild salmon and steelhead populations. And one of the greatest threats to wild salmon and steelhead populations are the Four Lower Snake Dams. The Four Lower Snake Dams were built to do one thing. I mean, they basically tout hydropower and irrigation and flood control. But in reality, those dams were built to make Lewiston a seaport, which it is now. The reality is yes, Lewiston is a seaport, but it's basically a seaport that's supported by taxpayer dollars. In other words, it doesn't turn a profit. It doesn't pay its own way. The Port of Lewiston and the other ports and the river shipping industry on the Lower Snake are supported by taxpayer dollars, as will be the expansion of the Port of Lewiston. Now, the Port of Lewiston, they have their shipments to the port have decreased at least tenfold over the last 10 years. In other words, they ship far less now than they shipped 10 years ago. They ship about 10% of what they shipped 10 years ago. And somehow they've come up with an idea that if they double the size of their dock, the dock that handles 10 times the amount of freight 10 years ago, if they double the size of that dock, somehow it would bring renewed economic vitality to Lewiston. Of course, they need taxpayer dollars to do this with as well, and we consider this just to be a classic pork barrel project, and it's amazing that our conservative congressional delegation and our conservative state government is a structure that touts fiscal responsibility and independence is so anxious to just add to the gravy train of the Port of Lewiston.
Well, Kevin, that's exactly what it is. It's a pork barrel project specialty, if there ever was one. And like I like to say, we need less pork and more salmon. And so certainly Friends of the Clearwater, Idaho Rivers United, and other groups are closely following the developments down in Lewiston concerning the Port of Lewiston, and also the future decisions here of the Army Corps of Engineers. So let's talk a little bit about Lonesome Larry, Kevin. Can you tell our listeners what is the Lonesome Larry campaign about, and has it been effective?
Sure. So Lonesome Larry, I think most people know who Lonesome Larry is, but just in case you don't, this is the 20th anniversary of Lonesome Larry. And Lonesome Larry was the one sockeye salmon that returned to Redfish Lake 20 years ago. I mean, basically, that population is functionally extinct. We're spending millions of dollars a year with hatchery programs to keep sockeye, alive, so to speak. I mean, I'm not going to fault Fish and Game. They're doing an amazing job with a hatchery program, as hatcheries go. But I mean, they're doing amazing genetic work. Every fish that comes back, They sample genetics, and they only breed the most distant fish to distant fish, so you haven't got the old brothers and sisters thing going on. But Lonesome Larry, we thought that 20 years, it was time to kind of revive people's understanding of Lonesome Larry. So this year we hired an intern and her boyfriend, dressed her up in a salmon suit, and sent her around the state of Idaho to ride in parades and see the sights and go to public events and basically publicize Lonesome Larry in the last 20 years. in the hopes that, of raising the awareness that, that we're still a long ways from wild salmon and steelhead recovery in this state. I mean, you'll hear, you know, the dam lovers in Washington State proclaiming that, that salmon runs are all-time high and blah, blah, blah. But that's not really very factual. What's an all-time high, if it's an all-time high, is hatchery fish that are coming back. We're flooding the system with hatchery fish, not wild fish. And I think that, that, that all of us agree that, that what we want to see is self-sustaining populations of wild salmon and steelhead back in Idaho. And so Lonesome Larry was just kind of a little year-long campaign. We put a blog site together. It's the lonesomelarry.org or lonesomelarry.com. We'll get you there, and you'll see a bunch of photos and hear Andy do a great Lonesome Larry song that she did at Music Thing in Riggins. So it was kind of a fun little campaign, and just kind of to raise the awareness that, that we're not there yet. That we've got a long ways to go in salmon steelhead recovery.
Well, Kevin, I would like to let you know that I do have my Lonesome Larry t-shirt, and certainly I'm proud to wear it. And like you're saying, I hope Lonesome Larry isn't too lonesome in the future. And we need to continue to educate the public on the fact that wild salmon populations or runs in the Snake River Basin continue to decline, and that from a number of perspectives, hatchery fish production is not an acceptable alternative, at least when it comes to the Endangered Species Act, and also just the integrity and the ethical, political, economical considerations of recovering wild salmon populations. So like you said, we do have a long ways to go. Now, how about some of the other campaigns that Idaho Rivers United is working on? Is there anything in particular that you'd like to share with our audience today?
Well, I'll just kind of give you a run-through of, I just kind of started jotting down some of the stuff I'm working on. And, you know, in no particular order, you know, wild and scenic implementation, you know, the implementation of the Oahe Initiative. You know, we sit on the board of directors, and, you know, we're about to get a wild and scenic river management plan sometime in October to look at. I do a lot of work with hydropower licensing, fighting attempts to build new dams in Idaho, general water policy work, water rights, water conservation, minimum stream flows, forest planning, water quality, mining. I mean, just yesterday, the land board, in their infinite wisdom, you know, issued a lease for suction dredging on the Maine salmon down below Riggins. Just another bad idea, of which there tend to be a lot of them sometimes.
Yeah, I'm. Thank you for informing us and our listeners of that latest development concerning dredging along the Maine Salmon River Maine Salmon River just below Riggins. Certainly been following that in the paper, and I know the land board was had a field visit scheduled, and to educate us further, now that that permit or that go ahead has been granted by the land board, are there any ways to stop this foolish project?
Yes, there are. I mean what the land board and basically the state of Idaho, they're happily leasing land and issuing dredge permits. But what they realize that by law, a suction dredge requires a Clean Water Act permit, requires an NPDES permit, because it is a discharge. And so any dredge operations required to have an NPDES permit. As far as I know, nobody has NPDES permits right now. So they are, if you're operating a dredge in Idaho, you're subject to the EPA issuing you a notice of violation right now, and you're subject to citizen lawsuits for Clean Water Act violations. So, yeah, there are certainly ways to address this. It gets more complicated than that, but, you know, at the 50,000-foot level, yeah, there's definitely ways to address this. In our opinion, that's an inappropriate activity on that part of the Salmon River. That's a very important ESA species corridor. I mean, that's a migratory corridor for spring, summer Chinook. It's spawning habitat for fall Chinook. It's a corridor for sockeye. It's a corridor for steelhead. It's a corridor for bull trout. All ESA listed species. Just downriver from that dredging location, there is a section of the Salmon River that's actually exceeds federal limits or state limits for mercury contamination. So you have mercury accumulations in fish tissue in the main stem salmon already. And dredging, you know, mercury like gold is the heaviest thing around, so it worked its way down to the sediments and sits on top of the bedrock. And when you dredge, you have to dredge down through all that overburden to get down to the bedrock to actually get the gold-bearing materials, and you'll also get mercury at the same time. So mobilizing mercury back into the water column is not what you want to be doing, and especially when you have just downstream a section of the river that's already on the state's 303 D list for mercury contamination. So, yeah, that's about it.
Well, that something tells me, Kevin, that that this issue, we're going to be hearing more about it, regardless of whether or not the land board has made their decision, their final decision. It seems like there are other issues or components of the project that still need to be resolved before this goes further. Now, I know you're a tireless worker, and I appreciate all the work that you do and that you have been doing. Let's talk about having fun. When you're not punching that clock, do you have a favorite river that you like to paddle on or just kind of spend some time on and get away?
You know, people always try and pin me down with this favorite river question. you know, like I said, I've been a river runner for 50 years now, and I mean, I've run rivers all across America and in a couple of other countries as well, and every river is just amazing and unique. You know, up here, the Locksaw. I mean, Locksaw, you know, in your neck of the woods. Long before I moved to Idaho, I would make the 15-hour drive from California to run the Locksaw. So the Locksaw is way high on my list. One of my reasons to come to Boise was the North Fork of the Payette. I love the North Fork. So really, I mean, Hell's Canyon, I mean, geez, I could go on, you know, for hours. But they're all unique. They're all amazing resources. It's just great to get out and be on a river somewhere.
Well, for those of you that have been listening, today we're joined by Kevin Lewis, the Conservation Policy Director for the group Idaho Rivers United. And Kevin, I know it's getting a little late here in the interview. Maybe one last question for you. How can our listeners, how can the public get more involved in the really important work that IRU is doing?
Sure, you can track me down easily. Kevin@idorivers.org. I would love your help in all these different issues. You know, one of our goals is to involve citizens. And we're a small organization. We're a small staff, and it's a big state with lots of issues. And so, you know, one of my goals has always been to try and build a much larger volunteer network across the state, so that local people know what's going on in their area much more so than I do. Many times, I get a call, but I don't get that call until something's been going on for months or years after the fact. And a lot of times, the sooner you can jump on this stuff, the greater your chances of making a difference. So track me down, come to our website, idahorivers.org, go check out lonesomelarry.org, because he's pretty cool, he's a stud. And I'm just, give me a call, email me, I'd love to hear from you.
Well, Kevin, hey, thanks a lot. Thank you for all the work that Idaho Rivers United is doing, and thank you for being a guest on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. I don't know when I'm going to see you next, but I hope it's sooner than later.
Great. Appreciate it. Thanks for your time. Thanks for inviting me.
All right, Kevin. Well, you're very welcome again. Check out the important work that Idaho Rivers United is doing around the state, www.idahorivers.org. And like they like to say, if you love a river, well, Heck, please get involved with this group. Again, www.idahorivers.org. Let's take a short music break, and then we'll wrap up the Wild Clearwater Country Show. This is KRFP, Moscow.
Seem true. Got a little secret here for you. And I've never had to worry, 'cause you've always had a plan. Each moment that I'm with you, I can see just who I am. And I've never had to worry, and I know I've had the blues, and I know my time is passing, and it's here in front of you. And no one can tell me different, 'cause I know I've been the fool, and each fool knows every secret. But if not for you, if not for you, and I know I was deceitful, and each darkness of the day looked at you and smiled. I had no more words to say, and I've never had to worry, 'cause you've always had a plan. And each moment that I'm with you, I can see just who I am. And I've never had to worry, and I know I've had the blues, and I know my time is passing, and it's here in front of you. And no one can tell me different, 'cause I know I've been the fool, and a fool knows every secret. And if not for you, if not for you, never had to worry, 'cause you've always had a plan. And each moment that I'm with you, I can see just who I am. And I've never had to worry, and I know I've had the blues, and I know my time is passing, and it's here in front of you. And no one can tell me different, 'cause I know I've been the fool, and each fool knows every secret. And it's just because of you, because of you, because of you, because of you.
And welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Well, I want to extend another thank you to Kevin Lewis, Conservation Policy Director with the group Idaho Rivers United, for being a guest today on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. And another good group to get involved with, particularly if you care about big, beautiful, wild rivers and the native species that inhabit them. So I would also like to remind everyone that the views expressed on the Wild Clearwater Country Show are not necessarily those of KRFP Moscow or any other organizations, but rather those opinions of the individuals on the show. So nonetheless, We got a few minutes to go here, and before we give you the weather report, wanted to let everyone know that on Friday, November 3rd, Friends of the Clearwater is going to be having its 25th anniversary annual meeting and gathering in the great room of the 1912 Center. And that's right, 25 years, hard to believe. I was running around in elementary school, and when people like Steve Paulson had the vision and the leadership to recognize that the Clearwater Basin is the wildest place in the lower 48, and we need to work together to make sure that the place is getting the protections that it deserves. And so again, Friday, November 3rd, 6 to 10 p.m. in the great room of the 1912 Center. It'll be the Friends of the Clearwater 25th anniversary annual gathering and meeting, and certainly we'll be talking more about that in the weeks to come. Now let's give you a quick weather report. Tonight, partly smoky, clear with low around 48, winds out of the west between 5 and 8. Tomorrow, areas of smoke, sunny with a high near 83, winds will be light and variable. Thursday night, areas of smoke after 11 p.m., clear with low around 49. Winds will be light out of the northeast, around 6 miles an hour Thursday night. Friday, sunny with a high near 86. Winds will be coming out of the east, around 5 miles an hour. Friday night, clear with low around 50. Winds will be light out of the east. Saturday, sunny with a high near 85. Saturday night, mostly clear with low around 51. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 83. Sunday night, partly cloudy with a low around 51. So again, want to thank everyone for listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show, and you are listening to KRFP Moscow.
KRFP thanks its donors and underwriters, including
Mikey's Gyros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine such as gyros, falafel, hummus, tabbouleh, and spanakopita, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
You are listening to KRFP Moscow.
We are now no longer the knights who say Nikish. We are now the knights who say
KRFP Moscow.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report, who takes a closer look at what triggered the anger and violence in the Muslim world in response to the circulation of an anti-Islamic film trailer. Marjorie Cohen, professor of law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild, who talks about a federal court ruling that challenges the government's right to indefinitely detain terrorist suspects and those accused of supporting terrorism. And Anne Wright, a retired colonel in the U.S. Army Reserves turned peace activist, who discusses the challenges facing the Occupy Wall Street movement as activists celebrated their one-year anniversary in New York City. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After 50 years of military rule and isolation, Myanmar, the nation formerly known as Burma, in a step toward economic reform, granted MasterCard a license to operate in the Southeast Asian country. It may be a sign of things to come as some of the world's largest banks and insurance companies, like Citibank, wait in line to do business in Myanmar, a nation of 60 million mostly poor people. Telecom and energy interests are also exploring the prospects of investing in Myanmar after 15 years of Western economic sanctions imposed to counter the military's repression of the democracy movement led by Aung San Suu Kyi. Still, Burmese civil society insists broad social reforms are required before the flood of foreign investment arrives. They advocate for investment in services like electricity, healthcare, education, improved public transit, and land reform. Human rights activists are fearful foreign companies investing in the energy and mining sector will make deals with those responsible for past rights abuses under military rule, including the widespread use of forced labor. Many activists are also opposed to any Western investment deals involving the state-owned Myanmar oil and gas enterprise, as it has been linked to massive corruption. Over the summer, the Obama administration put new conditions on U.S. companies moving to invest in Myanmar. However, Jennifer Quigley of the U.S. campaign in Burma called the new investment rules inadequate, declaring there's no probation on the Myanmar military.